You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Russell Kirk is recognized as one of the most influential thinkers and writers of the 20th century. His 1953 book, The Conservative Mind, was hailed by the New York Times, calling it an intellectual Bible of the conservative movement. And besides being a leading political philosopher, Kirk turned out ghost stories and gothic thrillers. And in a piece for the Historical Society of Michigan, my next guest points to Russell Kirk's Michigan upbringing in shaping a mind that helped to shape conservatism. Gleaves Whitney is the director of the Hauenstein Center for Presidential Studies at Grand Valley State University, and his article is titled Russell Kirk, the Wizard of Macosta. Gleaves, always great to talk with you on Stateside.
Thank you, Cindy.
So tell us, where does Russell Kirk stand in the pantheon of political thinkers?
Well, he was very influential in setting up the post-war conservative movement. He contributed mightily to it through his Conservative Mind and other writings starting in 1953. But I would say he's a different kind of conservative. I think today most people think of conservatism as a sort of the holdover of the Republican country club type member, the titan on Wall Street and that sort of thing. And that certainly is an element of the conservative movement. Russell Kirk was a very different kind of conservative. He was what he would call a Burkean conservative after Edmund Burke, the parliamentarian and political philosopher in Britain as the French Revolution broke out. Russell was also just a tremendously imaginative person. He wrote a lot of fiction. He was interested in living off the land. He was, I think, a conservationist. He was somebody who had socialist friends. For example, he liked Norman Thomas back in the 50s. He loved Eugene McCarthy in the Vietnam War era. When I go out and speak about Russell, people don't realize that a conservative, especially one of the founders of the conservative movement, could have that kind of a profile. But Russell breaks the mold in so many ways.
When I know he defined himself as a traditionalist conservatism. What does that actually mean?
It means that you respect what brung you here to this point. I think most conservatives believe that civilization is a pretty fragile achievement. It has to be re-nurtured every generation, or you can start to lose great ground. You know, if the teachers quit teaching, if the preachers quit preaching, if the makers of things quit making things, your civilization can start to fall apart. And you can look at the historical record, as Russell did extensively, the whole world record, and you can see there were about 28 civilizations that existed, and only four of those still survive. So one out of seven civilizations survives, the rest fall off the map. I mean, that's something that will make you sit up straight in your chair. So the conservative's thinking, well, what is it that makes a civilization survive? There's this tension between carrying forward tradition, but the other side of that coin is also being able to adapt and change and progress at a pace that is mindful of the tradition, but adapts to new realities, new pressures that the civilization faces. So even though he's called a traditionalist, he's also very mindful of the needed changes that have to happen for the civilization, for the country to survive.
And in the piece you wrote for the Historical Society of Michigan, you make a case that it was Kirk's Michigan roots in Plymouth and Macosta that inspired his thinking. You put it as the two interior states of Kirk's mind. So let's start with Plymouth. How did that city, that city's history, shape one of Michigan's most famous writers?
Well, Plymouth is very much, first of all, let me point out that both of these communities are really in the center of the old Northwest. If you look at the Northwest Territory that was created in 1787 by the founders of this country, you know, it extended all the way from the, you know, Ohio border with Pennsylvania all the way up to the Mississippi headwaters. So this area where Kirk was right in the center of this large area. It was settled by a large number of New England immigrants who came in from the East Coast as the Erie Canal opened. And it so happened that Plymouth itself was very much settled by Connecticut Yankees and people who held to their roots with Plymouth Rock and all of the legends there. So Plymouth is very much a New England town, and its very origins are New Englandish.
And it looks New Englandish with that beautiful Kellogg Park, the town square.
Exactly. Yeah. The town square, which is not technically, it's not, you know, geometrically a square, but it's symbolically at the center. It brings people together. And that's sort of the civic republicanism, little r, civic republicanism, that Americans wanted to foster when they were building this country. So there are a lot of things. There's the civic Republican idea of service. So you see that in the war memorials around town. Russell would have, when he walked to school, would have gone by those war memorials to the fallen soldiers of the Spanish-American War and the Civil War, the Mexican War, that kind of thing. And then you have the town square that brings people together. You have a moral earnestness that he would have seen during the 1930s when there were a lot of philanthropies, charities helping people deal with the fallout from the Great Depression. So Russell was very much oriented to this New England, this austere sense of service to others above self. But then, Plymouth also began to change. Around the beginning of the 20th century, it was attracting railroads and industries. BB guns were manufactured there, for example. So it has a lot of other industries that Russell, recognized were providing jobs, but he did not want for the New England roots to be lost in all of that. So he always held in tension that old Plymouth that was founded by those hardy New England settlers with their civic Republican values and virtues, and then the new requirements of the new age to provide jobs and an infrastructure that works for a modern civilization. But he was a traditionalist. He favored the old. He did not want it to disappear. In an age of progress and of rapid change and creative destruction of capitalism, he was saying, what are we losing in the creative destruction that's really precious, that's important for us to be humans in community with one another?
And then how was Plymouth balanced by what he loved about McCosta, kind of a yin-yang there?
That's exactly right. That's a good way to put it, Cindy. That McCosta, Michigan's up in the Stump Country. It's about 200 miles to the northwest of Detroit. McCosta was a lumber town and a frontier town, but once it had been abandoned, once the frontier bypassed it and people left the region and just left sort of the old storefronts and the stump country where all the trees had been cut, there was something very haunting about it to Russell. And he believed that McCosta kept hold of this haunting spirit and inspired many of his ghost stories, as a matter of fact, ghost stories which have been favorably compared to those of Stephen King. And he just thought that there was a silence there that was left in the vacuum of where, the Native Americans had been and had thrived in that wonderful country in the middle of Michigan. Then progress had come and then left the place abandoned, and there was a quality of silence that fascinated Russell. And Russell wanted to give it voice through his short stories and through his traditionalist principles. It was important then for this yin and yang, as you put it, to work together. And I think it did in the inside of his consciousness, to get away from the Detroit metro area in the summer times, go up north, as we say here in Michigan, and be in the wilderness with this kind of ghostly presence of the past.
He got his bachelor's at Michigan State University and then went on to get a master's at Duke and a doctor of letters from St. Andrews in Scotland. And I know he came back to East Lansing to teach at MSU, but there was some kind of rupture, right? Because didn't he break from MSU and kind of spend the rest of his days calling it Cow College or Behemoth University? What happened?
Well, he and President John Hanna came to blows. Russell became very critical of sort of what he called a factory approach to higher education. He said, why do we put these kids, these 18-year-old minds that are so curious, they still have a sense of wonder. Why do we lock them up in a lecture hall with 300, 400 other people? It's dehumanizing. It's not personal. It's not geared to really quality discussion. And that's at the root of education. You need to have that kind of relationship with your fellow students and with the professor to teach each other. And you can't get it from multiple choice exams in a big lecture hall. So he criticized John Hanna's big push to make Michigan State a powerhouse university. He was critical of Michigan State's emphasis on athletics at the time. And the rupture meant that he really wasn't a happy camper, decided to go back to his ancestral home, not in Plymouth, but in McCosta now, where his mother's family had put down roots. And he stayed there for the next four decades writing, but he always used Michigan State. He always held it up as a model of what not to become. I mean, he was insulting to there's no other way to put it. He was insulting to the president of the university, insulting of its goals, and thought that if this is the trend in higher education in America, that we really were going to lose sort of the humanistic perspective that education should instill in us.
Glaives, Russell Kirk died in 1994. Would he recognize conservative America and the Republican Party of 2018? What do you think he would make of Donald Trump?
I think Russell Kirk would weep. He would sob at what has become of the conservative movement and at some of the political so-called leadership we've had. He would be heartbroken because he was inspired by people like Edmund Burke, whom we've mentioned, by John Adams. If you looked at the founders, Thomas Jefferson, people who had a real humane sense of what the purpose of political community is. How then should we live together? We're a democracy that requires people to be able to discuss issues in a civil way. Our very Constitution requires it by having checks and balances and a federated system. It requires people to tack a little bit toward the center. They're still able to hold their values, of course, but they have to be able to communicate with others in a civil way. Russell was big on civil discourse. His personal friendships with people like Arthur Schlesinger Jr., who was a progressive historian, showed, he demonstrated what it was like to have to come from a different place philosophically, but to be able to sit down, come, let us reason together. Let's discuss what's at stake with our civilization. The name calling, the fact that everything has been dumbed down, the tweets, the rapid fire quips and insults would just, I think, for him, indicate that we have really descended into dangerous territory. I think he has a lot to teach us on the upside of this, Cindy. This is why we should be reading Russell Kirk, because he offers a model of what a conservatism that's not necessarily identical with Republican politics, but what a conservatism should look like and how to restore humane values, how to be able to get along with socialists, yes, socialists like Norman Thomas, and progressives like Arthur Schlesinger Jr. Russell demonstrated this in a very gracious personality, and we all still can learn a lot from him. I know I do personally.
Russell Kirk, The Wizard of Macosta, the article by Gleaves Whitney in the Historical Society of Michigan. Gleaves, of course, director of the Hauenstein Center for Presidential Studies at Grand Valley State University. Gleaves, thank you so very much.
Thank you.